You're listening to Current State on WKAR. In the continued fight against the invasive Asian carp, scientists are trying to learn as much as they can in order to use that knowledge to keep the fish out of the Great Lakes. One thing that's pretty helpful to know, how carp pick up mates. A researcher in Canada is studying a phenomenon called landmarking, which is not a lot different than what happens at the town tavern on a Saturday night. I talked with Dr. Kim Cuddington, associate professor in the Department of Biology at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, about what landmarking means and how taking advantage of it could keep carp from making more carp.
Landmarking is really the human equivalent of going where everybody else is hanging out in order to find a mate. So if you're a butterfly, you would go to the highest hilltop that you could see in the immediate vicinity, and everybody else would do that too. So then you'd have a high probability of meeting someone of the opposite sex. But a landmark can be almost anything, depending on the species you're talking about. It can be a tuft of grass if you're small enough. For fish species, it could be a nice, fast river that's exiting into a lake. There's all kinds of things that are used as landmarks.
How does this apply to the invasive carp problem?
Well, one of the things that people might have in mind when they think about whether an invasive species is going to be successful or not is that if there's protection measures in place, you go, oh, well, only a few fish will ever get beyond those protection measures, and therefore there's really a low likelihood that a male and a female will be together in the same place at the same time and mate and have kids. Like, that just doesn't seem likely. But if the case is that a few fish get through and they all head to the same location at the same time, then you can see that the odds of a male and female finding each other and mating and being successful in bringing up offspring is pretty high.
It seems to me that it would be an awful lot easier to predict what a critter would think of as a good landmarking spot. Like you said, the butterflies, for instance, mm-hmm. if you go to a high place, you see a whole bunch of butterflies together, you can kind of assume. It seems like that would be extremely problematic to figure out through the eyes of a fish, not only what they consider attractive, but also because you're dealing with so much area that you're not able to watch.
In the case of the invasive carp, we already know what they like. They like warm, fast, large rivers. And there's only a few of those on every one of the Great Lakes, so maybe about 10 potential candidates on most of the lakes. And so, yeah, that's pretty easy to figure out for Asian carp.
Interesting. How do you just watch where they spawn, or is that kind of the giveaway?
This is known life history, and I guess, yes, people watched where they spawned in their native range in China because, of course, there's a lot of commercial interest in that species there. They're used as a food source. But, yeah, it's just known life history for the species.
You use mathematical modeling in biology. Tell us some of the ways that that is a useful tool, just as a, kind of as a side note to this, so we understand.
Oh, sure. Well, anyone who works with populations, so managed populations in particular, populations that you're going to harvest, populations that are endangered, populations that might be invasive, it's all about a numbers game, right? You're always trying to predict how large the population could be, how many we could take as a harvest and not cause the population to crash, what's the likelihood that a population is going to actually establish in a new region. So, yeah, population ecology in particular is all about the numbers, all about the math.
You recently did a study that established that it would only take 10 Asian carp to establish a decent-sized population.
Oh, okay. Well, let's be a little careful.
Oh, okay.
The paper said that to have a 50% chance, so a 50-50 chance of getting an established population, you needed a minimum of 10 males and 10 females.
Okay, this is why we talk to the scientists and not just read the press release. But if you could explain a little bit more about how you arrived at that.
Sure, this is a precursor to the landmarking paper, but at that time we still knew that Asian carp liked particular locations, and we knew that there was about 10 or so of these locations on every lake. What we did is we parameterized a model with all of the things that we knew about their life history, like how long it took them to become sexually mature, how many offspring they might have. And we put all of that information into a population model, and then we said, okay, but we're on a great big huge lake. So let's now investigate the effect of dividing the males and females up into a number of different locations on the lake, the corresponding to a number of different potential spawning rivers. And so I looked at a whole range. So I looked at like 0 to 100 spawning rivers on a given lake. But of course, the reality is that there's much less than that, about 10. If there are about 10 rivers that are suitable, then we ran the population model. We said, what's the probability of a male and a female meeting? And then what's the probability that they successfully have offspring? And then what's the probability that those offspring successfully continue reproducing to reach some population size that we suggested might be a dangerous size, so greater than 1,000 fish?
I hate to say it, but it almost sounds like this could have implications for dating websites.
You know, it probably does. Not websites per se, but maybe websites. It's a location thing. So being at the right place at the right time. I'm not quite sure. You'd have to think about who was online and what drove that. I always think about the bar example. I don't know. I must be archaic, but the bar example is really good, right? What bar do I go to at what time so that there are the most people there, more particularly the most number of the opposite sex there, and that's going to increase my probability of finding a mate. And time changes it as well. You've got to think about, well, how long are these, for example, male and female fish likely to stay in that location? If they stay a long time, you have a high probability of finding a mate, but if you only go for a day or so, then you have a much lower probability. So now everybody's got to stay at the bar for hours and hours.
Dr. Kim Cuddington is a professor at the University of Waterloo in Canada. So between these two studies, the one that talked about how many carp it would take to establish a reasonable population in the Great Lakes, and the thing about the landmarking, what applications do you feel these could have in the fight against Asian carp getting into the Great Lakes?
Well, I guess one of the things is it would help target control measures, right? If you know that these fish have a spawning period and you want to apply a control measure like fishing them out or whatever it is, you know where to go to find the most number of fish, right? We know some other things about life history, too, that you could also target juveniles as well. But the landmarking per se does suggest that if you want to control the adult population, go to where they're all going to hang out to look for mates.
You know, mostly when we do Asian carp stories, we hear about policy. You know, what there's this one place that they think from the river that is going to get into the Great Lakes, and they want to put something there, like some kind of barrier or whatever. It almost seems what you're talking about sounds a lot more finely tuned than almost anything else I've heard talked about in the whole Asian carp debate. I mean, do you feel like
well,
the science?
I think one of the things that the studies point out is the magnitude of the risk occurs at a much lower, a large magnitude of risk occurs at a lower number of fish than what the managers, I think, had been previously thinking about. So when people talk about the ship and sanitary canal in Chicago, and they're always like, oh, it's only going to be a couple of fish, and you're sitting there thinking, well, if it's a couple of fish every year, it doesn't take long to get 20 fish swimming around in the same lake. That, you know, that's a couple of years. They're long-lived animals. So in one sense, it's kind of a bad news story in that, gosh, you really have to be good at keeping fish out of your lake, right to have minimal risk. In another way, it's a kind of a good news story in that, you know, with these models, we can sort of pinpoint the places where control would have the most impact. So spatial locations, also temporal stuff. We haven't talked about it, but the life history models also pointed out that juvenile survival was really important to large risk. So the juveniles cluster in warm, shallow, marshy areas. That's quite different than all the other life history stages of this fish, but you could target your control measures on the juveniles and have a large impact on population growth.
Do you feel like the people who are making policy on this are considering the science on it correctly or not?
There's a lot of resistance to the original papers that we put out about the risk factors with small number of fish, but I think that's being taken on board at this point. And folks are thinking more seriously about rapid response and more comprehensive control measures.
Dr. Kim Cuddington is at the University of Waterloo. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.